Chamber of Commerce, which had advocated tariff protection for much of its history, now highlighted the importance of imports to the United States economy. Its president, Earl Shreve, insisted that the United States had to act as a responsible creditor, taking measures to balance trade and extending Marshall Plan dollars as a stopgap measure to tide Europe over temporarily. Such pronouncements reflected a growing belief among business elites that the competitive position of the United States was as secure as it had ever been, and that using economic tools to contain Soviet aggression was necessary to sustain it. Business support, however, was far from universal. The president of the National Industrial Conference Board, Virgil Jordan, denounced the Marshall Plan as the most insidious and dangerous development of the deliberate Soviet communist conspiracy to undermine and cripple the economic power of the United States. The dollar shortage, he said, was merely a semantic trick, and financial aid as a means of outbidding communism was an infantile illusion. Many business leaders saw the aid component of the plan as inflationary. Cotton and textile interests also expressed concern at potential harm to American business, though generally in more moderate language than Jordan. Valid though Reston's observation was, isolationism had not been abandoned as an aspiration. Congressmen defended support for the Marshall Plan on the grounds that America needed to take responsibility for shaping matters abroad today, so that it might be free of the obligation forevermore once the crisis had passed. The flimsy foundation on which such beliefs rested would become manifest as the Cold War progressed from crisis to crisis. Yet they would never pass from the national psyche. They would reemerge in populist tomes over half a century later with the implosion of communism as a political force. Two practical questions came to dominate legislative debate over the Marshall Plan. Who should run it, and how big it should be? With respect to the program's management, conflict erupted early on over the role of the State Department. For Republicans, the notion of Truman's Foreign Service bureaucrats remaking European economies was a non-starter. It meant incompetence, inefficiency, and a reliance on meddling over markets. It would undermine America's economy as well as Europe's. In response, the Herter Committee and others came together around the idea of creating a new independent agency to be run by prominent individuals with business backgrounds recruited from outside government. The White House split over the scope for compromise. Treasury supported the idea. State, which had always expected to run the program, was alarmed. Lovett began searching for common ground back in September 1947, when he appointed a special committee under the chairmanship of Lincoln Gordon, a former director of the Civilian Production Administration's Bureau of Reconversion Priorities, to draft an administrative blueprint for the ERP. Reporting 1 month later, it called Solomon-like for management of the program to be split. An Economic Cooperation Administration, ECA, would be created to handle operational issues, while decisions related to foreign policy would remain with the State Department. Kennan feared that the operation of the ERP administration will make it difficult for this department itself to conduct any incisive and vigorous policy with relation to Europe. But Marshall embraced the proposal as the best he was likely to get. While insisting that the strategic direction of the ERP, being a matter of foreign policy, had to remain with State, Marshall advised the president to call for lodging direct operational responsibility for this hazardous and temporary undertaking outside the department. There was, Clifford argued, an element of political benefit to Truman in giving ground to Congress. If Republicans wanted a separate body to implement the program and problems emerged, the president could blame Congress. Republicans pressed to keep the State Department at arm's length, arguing that its interference would make it impossible to recruit the best brains and managerial talent to run the ECA. Marshall, however, fought to maintain State's strategic oversight. There cannot, he insisted before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee on January 8, 1948, be two secretaries of state. The whole procedure of this program certainly directly affects the foreign relations of the United States, he told the House Committee on Foreign Affairs 4 days later. In the end, splitting responsibility between the State Department, which would set policy, and the ECA, which would control operations, would prove the only politically viable solution. There remained the matter, however, of who would run the ECA. Truman determined to avoid any possibility of conflict between State and the ECA, pressed for Acheson or Clayton. Republican Majority Whip Kenneth Wherry assailed Acheson on the Senate floor for having supported Bretton Woods and the Morgenthau Plan, the latter of which had cost the United States more than $20 billion. That was now out of the window, and Mr. Acheson is out of the government, and I think that is a good thing. Vandenberg insisted on recruiting someone from the outside business world, someone with particularly persuasive economic credentials unrelated to diplomacy. Clayton, of course, had had a successful career in private business, but his time in two Democratic administrations disqualified him politically. The overriding congressional desire, Vandenberg told Marshall, is that the ERP administrator come to the job, not via the State Department. This principle did much to conciliate Taft, who praised the final Senate bill as infinitely more acceptable than the White House version. Acheson and Clayton were out, yet the question of who would run the ECA would not be resolved until after the legislative fight ended. With regard to funding, the administration pushed for $17 billion over 4 years, at the upper end of the Harriman Committee estimate of what was needed. Now, it does seem to me that we can afford over a 4-year period to risk $17 billion for peace, Truman said at a January 29th press conference. It was $4 billion less than the 1948 defense budget, but less than one-fourth of the half-year that was made a rescission under war. It was also $12.2 billion less than what the 16 European participants had wanted in Paris, and $2.3 billion less than what they ultimately settled on under friendly American guidance. Vandenberg approved Truman's headline figure, but thought it too large for Congress to swallow in one bite. He wanted the funds doled out in tranches that would have to be approved each year. The State Department, however, hated the idea of having to return to Congress annually for a new multi-billion dollar appropriation. Marshall scolded Congress to do the job in full, or don't undertake it at all. The White House ultimately bowed to political reality, narrowing its request to $6.8 billion for the 15 months from April 1, 1948, to June 30, 1949, the end of the following fiscal year. Hoover, however, the great rallying figure for the anti-ERP forces, called on Vandenberg to cut the initial appropriation to $4 billion. Taft also threatened to press for delay until the next fiscal year, starting July 1st. By transforming a 15-month program into a 12-month one, this would cut the price tag by 25% to $5.1 billion. It was another bleak winter in Europe. Britain's reserves had fallen to $2.4 billion, $24 billion in today's money, in dollars, gold, and assorted, unexhausted credits. They were expected to run dry by the summer. After that, it will just be impossible to buy either the food or the raw materials necessary for Britain to eat and work, said the economist. The aspect of starvation and mass unemployment is now alarmingly close. Europeans followed the politics of the Marshall Plan with great interest. Yet public opinion was split as to the main American objective behind the plan. In both France and Britain, 1 in 4 thought it was humanitarian. The same proportion thought it was economic self-interest. 1 in 7 believed it was to stop communism. Italians were more generous. 1 in 3 thought the main motive was humanitarian. The Dutch were skeptical. Only 1 in 10 believed this. 4 times as many believed it was economic self-interest. European governments, for their part, were sensitive to both the substance and politics of the aid conditions being debated in Washington. The CEEC delegation to Washington, informally known as the European Group, several times expressed written concern about how the U.S. government might restrict the way in which their countries spend the proceeds of the domestic sale of American aid supplies, what became known as counterpart funds. All those in Europe who have continually opposed the so-called Marshall Plan, said an October 27, 1947 European Group memo to the State Department, will seek to show that the existence of these funds is capable of conferring upon the U.S. considerable powers infringing our independence. They urged, therefore, that recipient governments, rather than an American agency, be permitted to control the allocation of such funds in accordance with any agreements reached with the U.S. government. The Kremlin viewed European enthusiasm for the Marshall Plan with alarm. In a top-secret memorandum to Stalin on January 26, 1948, Central Committee Agitprop Chief Suslov reported on the proceedings of the International Conference of Socialist Parties in Antwerp. The ruling Democratic Socialist Parties of Western Europe, he wrote, view the Marshall Plan as an almost miraculous rescue, and argued fiercely with their Czech and Polish counterparts against letting ideological debate hinder rapid implementation. Suslov warned that the Western socialists had one specific purpose, to organize opposition to the activities of the Communist Party. A bulletin of the Soviet military administration in Germany expressed equal concern about developments in Germany. Schumacher and his clique, standing at the head of the SPD, are dancing to the American tune. Another Central Committee report concluded that the collusion of the Anglo-American imperialists on the Germany questions that took place after the breakdown of the London Conference, on the basis of a refusal to cooperate with the Soviet Union, had led to a division of Germany, with West Germany becoming a half-colony dependent on America and serving its imperialist plans. The forces of German reaction, that is, the two Christian parties, the CDU and CSU, were now consolidating power on the basis of the acceptance of the Marshall Plan. A Russian magazine described Marshall as a belligerent old man, set on destroying the UN and starting a new criminal war. Truman was likened to Hitler. The TASS news agency and Moscow radio directed a regular stream of vitriol at the Marshall Plan, which was then spread throughout Communist Party mouthpieces in Bulgaria, Czechoslovakia, Romania, Hungary, Poland, Albania, Yugoslavia, Italy, and elsewhere. The CIA monitored the broadcast assiduously. State Department, War Department, and Office of Naval Intelligence officials in Europe reported back to Washington on developments in anti-American propaganda, which Voice of America radio transmissions then aimed to counter. Administration officials, Rustin noted, were growing alarmed over what they saw as Washington's incapacitation in the face of a disciplined and relentless Soviet campaign to spread its foreign policy through satellite governments. The classic doctrine of non-intervention, these officials were concluding, is a hazardous theory that requires reconsideration in the light of modern politics and ballistics. Conservative congressmen such as Massachusetts Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, Jr., began proposing funds to translate American newspapers for European distribution, buy ad space in European media, and boost VOA range through investment in medium and long-wave transmission. Though in the early fall there had been insufficient support to get a House bill boosting counter-Soviet VOA activities to the Senate floor, by the new year the atmosphere had changed dramatically. The Senate passed the bill unanimously on January 16, 1948. Truman signed it into law on the 28th. Over the first quarter of 1948, Congress held frequent hearings into the Marshall Plan. Vandenberg vested enormous importance in them. Determined as he was to compel public figures opining on the idea of a recovery program to state unequivocally what they actually wanted Congress to do. We won't hesitate to subpoena, Vandenberg said, if they did not volunteer to clarify and defend their views publicly. This was representative democracy at its most robust, with citizens compelled to participate in order to ensure that the decisions taken had the fingerprints of all who were claiming, through the power of the media, to know what the government should do. Vandenberg proved a master at eliciting the testimony his skeptical colleagues needed to hear. Frequently, he effectively delivered the testimony himself, leading the witnesses to agree with him enthusiastically. As I understand you, he said to Army Secretary Kenneth Royal during his Senate testimony on January 15th, what you were saying is that if it were not for the prospect of organized stabilization as a source of security, you envision an alternative situation which would require immediate and measurable appropriations for larger-scale national armaments than have been thus far requested? That is correct, sir, Royle responded. Put still more bluntly, is it fair to say that your judgment offers us the choice in part between appropriations for economic cooperation on the one hand, or greater appropriations for military purposes in the interests of our ultimate national security? That is my judgment, offered Royle. One of the many remarkable aspects of the debate was the outsized role of the House, which is normally the junior partner to the Senate in matters of foreign relations. But the central place of money in the Marshall Initiative thrust the House, owing to its power of the purse, into the position of full partner. In total, the House Foreign Affairs Committee would hear testimony from 25 administration spokesmen and hear or receive testimony from 150 private citizens. The transcripts filled 2,296 pages. The Senate Foreign Relations Committee would hear roughly half as much testimony, 9 governmental and 86 other witnesses, generating 1,466 pages. The scope of the questioning was exhaustive. Economics, administration, geopolitics, and military considerations. How much aid should there be? In grants? In loans? On what time scale? What should be the aims? What strings should be attached? Who should run the program? How will currencies be stabilized? How will inflation be controlled? How will trade be revived? How will Germany be handled? How will the Russians react? How will we deal with them? In his House testimony on January 12th, Marshall tried to train the spotlight on Soviet intentions by quoting CPSU Central Committee Secretary Andrei Zhdanov. As to the USSR, it will bend every effort in order that this plan be doomed to failure. 4 days later, on January 16th, the British Foreign Office revealed a copy of a secret Cominform document entitled Protocol M, laying out a scheme to undermine the Marshall Plan through mass worker strikes in Western Germany. The timing could not have been better for the White House, as the document buttressed Marshall's claims of an alien hand working to undermine European recovery. Moscow, however, attacked the document as a forgery. Upon conclusion of the American legislative drama, an embarrassed British intelligence service would declare that it had been. The theme of war and peace was a constant in the hearings. Ambassador Douglas, testifying on January 9th, echoed Marshall's argument that the alternative to a recovery program was continued and larger expenditures for national defense. Forrestal, elevated to defense secretary in September 1947, said the ERP would be far less expensive than standing isolated and alone in an unfriendly world. On the 20th, he told the House that failed legislation would mean moving the political frontier from Europe to somewhere in the Atlantic Ocean. John Foster Dulles, who would become Dewey's foreign policy adviser in the coming presidential campaign, told the Senate that if France were left to go communist, Congress would be hit with a military appropriations request that would make the ERP bill look like a bag of peanuts. But Congress still wasn't buying the either-or, aid or war framing. Might the aid plan itself possibly lead to war? Representative Lawrence Smith, Republican Wisconsin, asked the Secretary of State. No, Marshall insisted. To the contrary, it should avoid the issue. Yet Smith's concern was sound. If Congress backed the ERP, ever greater political and economic differences would come to define the nations that found themselves on opposing sides of the line Marshall referred to in his November testimony. It took no leap of imagination to conclude that the hardening of such differences would, in short order, take on a military dimension, as each side bound together with its American or Soviet patron to prevent the other encroaching into its prerogatives. Some congressmen urged the Secretary of State to begin preparing for war. Representative Chester Merrow, Republican New Hampshire, suggested to Marshall that the United States was, in building those countries up on the western side of his line, making them into rich prizes for an aggressor. The Soviet Union, he pointed out, had 3 times the fighting planes that we have. The United States, he said, needed urgently to develop an air force that could make our will felt around the world. Otherwise, the time may come when the 16 nations will be overwhelmed and we can do nothing about it. Not all the plan's supporters were singing from Marshall's hymn sheet. Financier philanthropist Bernard Baruch, testifying on January 19th, said that the Marshall Plan was no more than a good start. It had to be accompanied by political and military union in Western Europe. The United States and its European allies, he argued, should mutually guarantee against aggression. By guarantee, I mean a firm promise to go to war in joint defense if any of them are attacked. Such testimony was a distinctly discordant note for an administration anxious to highlight a prospective peace dividend. Across the Atlantic, however, Bevin echoed Baruch, "I've done and will continue to do all I can to bring the Marshall Plan to fruition," he said. "But essential though it is, progress in the economic field will not in itself suffice to call a halt to the Russian threat." "The time is right for the consolidation of Western Europe," he declared. "We are entitled to organize kindred souls in the West, just as the Soviets have organized kindred souls in the East." As Reston would point out, such an organization would require American military backing. The price tag for the Marshall Plan was also a major theme of the hearings. In the debate over cost, Congress was not, strictly speaking, vetting the administration's estimate of the sums needed to generate European recovery, so much as scrutinizing the administration's estimate of what Congress was willing to authorize. Yet sums were put forth in testimony as the finished products of a great scientific exercise, and defended as if they represented liberty itself. One administration official boasted to Reston that, to prepare for a presentation before Vandenberg's committee, his statisticians had made 40,000 calculations to back a single conclusion. Reston's source was most likely the leader of the statisticians, Paul Nitze, who, in Clayton's words, knew more about the Marshall Plan than perhaps any other individual in Washington. Using primitive computers borrowed from the Prudential Life Insurance Company, Nitze and his staff churned out the mass of calculations and charts that formed the Brown Books on recipient countries' finances, production, and needs. Embodying the irony of the capitalist planner, Nitze was the man who determined how much rice, rubber, iron, and the like would be required where and when, and what it would all cost. As the repository of the vast mass of numbers behind the Marshall Plan, he was naturally a man whom its opponents sought to discredit. Representative John Tabor, Republican New York, went so far as to solicit, through a secret intermediary, derogatory information on him from the FBI. What came back was speculation that his parents were communists. At hearings on how to appropriate aid, Tabor set out to undermine Nitze's aura as a data wizard by insisting on going alphabetically through every country and then commodity in his Brown Books, and forcing him to justify each figure from memory. He got as far as Austrian commodities, beginning with P, which revealed Nitze's inability to recount supply and demand estimates for pulses. "The man knows nothing," shouted Tabor. During the weeks of hearings, covering 43 sessions, Nitze lost 15 pounds from stress and overwork. Yet on February 21st, a major legislative hurdle was cleared. Vandenberg reported the ERP bill out of his committee, unanimously, to the full Senate for a vote. In the course of the hearings, he had forced two key concessions from the White House, enabling independent administration of the program and eliminating the politically toxic $17 billion four-year price tag. He slashed this figure to a less challenging $5.3 billion initial one-year appropriation, without brooking any challenge to the White House's full estimate of what was needed. Meanwhile, over in Europe, events were helping to boost congressional support. 9. Subversion. Despite having a mutual assistance treaty with the USSR, Czechoslovakia, which bordered both Western Germany and Ukraine, was a weak link in Stalin's defensive perimeter. Its communists trumpeted pursuit of the country's own path to socialism, which explained why they enjoyed greater popular support there than elsewhere in the East. But the United States and Britain had, according to a European Department official of the Soviet Foreign Ministry, worryingly, established their own centers of influence in the country. Reactionary forces had become more active in the struggle against progressive forces in the country, that is, the communists. Given that Czechoslovakia was now one of the main sources of uranium for Moscow's atomic weapons program, Stalin was on alert for signs of trouble. These signs had been building since the previous summer. On the eve of the Cominform gathering in September 1947, Molotov had complained to Zhdanov about the unreliability of the Czechoslovak armed forces and ordered him to raise the matter in Sklarska Poremba. Masaryk, meanwhile, continued to lament being prohibited from going to Paris in July. "We know that the United States will not consider us its favorite sons after the rejection of the Marshall Plan," he told the Czech paper Svobodne Slovo in October. "But we hope they will not completely forsake us." In December, the Soviet embassy in Prague cabled Moscow about troubling political developments. "Reactionary elements within the country, actively supported by representatives of the West, believe that the parties of the right will receive a majority at the forthcoming May 1948 elections, and that the communists will be thrown out of the government." Early in the new year, the National Socialists, the second largest party behind the communists, expressed public regret about not having joined in the Marshall Plan. Elements in the Communist Party now began agitating for Moscow to intervene. Stalin, who had been careful not to hand the West propaganda opportunities or to provoke anti-communist underground forces in the East, decided it was now time to make clear to which bloc the country belonged. This is what Kennan had warned would happen back in November. As long as communist political power was advancing in Europe, it was advantageous to the Russians to allow to the Czechs the outer appearances of freedom. It would permit the Czechs to serve as bait for the nations further west. But once the danger of the political movement proceeding in the other direction became apparent in Moscow, the Russians would no longer be able to afford this luxury. Czechoslovakia could stir liberal democratic forces elsewhere in the east. At that point, the Russians will clamp down completely on Czechoslovakia, even though they will try to keep their hand well concealed and leave us no grounds for formal protest. On February 18, 1948, the four Czechoslovak National Socialist ministers, Zenkel, Ripka, Drtina, and Education Minister Jaroslav Stransky, went to see Beneš to express their alarm over the communist purging of the Interior Ministry. Hardline Minister Václav Nosek was systematically replacing police commissioners with party loyalists, ignoring protests that his actions were illegal. Above all else, Zenkel explained, it was absolutely necessary to stop the communization of the police and the distribution of their arms and ammunition. The National Socialists, Populists, and Slovak Democrats would therefore resign their 12 ministerial posts, amounting to half the cabinet, in advance of the Communist Union Congress on the 22nd. The mass resignation would prevent the communists from shifting the spotlight from security to nationalization of industry, an issue on which they would gain support from the left-wing Social Democrats. The ministers wanted Beneš to demand the resignation of the remaining cabinet members from Gottwald, paving the way for either a new government that would reverse the security measures or new elections. Beneš, who had previously said that he would not stand for non-communist parties being eaten up one by one as had occurred in other Eastern European countries, buoyed them by agreeing to back new elections. The communists, he said, would never give way, as they could not win elections without controlling the police. As for the Russians who were orchestrating the crisis, the brutal way they had blocked Marshall aid for the country still angered him. The Bolsheviks shriek against Western imperialism to distract attention from their own aggressive expansionism, Beneš said. They are provoking the whole world with their behavior. The Soviet deputy foreign minister arrived in Prague unannounced the following day, February 19th. Officially, Valerian Zorin was on a mission to inspect Russian grain supplies. Masaryk and Ripka were incredulous. They understood that Zorin's presence was meant to demonstrate Moscow's support for the new communist security measures. Zorin, according to Ambassador Steinhardt, was not a forceful door-slamming type like Vyshinsky, but he delivered his boss's messages clearly enough. Meeting with Gottwald, the Russian told him the time had come to be firmer and to stop making concessions to those on the right. The premier had to be ready for decisive action and for the possibility of breaching the formal stipulations of the Constitution and the laws as they stand. Gottwald, Zorin reported back to Moscow, did not want to move against the president, who had wide popular support. The premier still clung, Zorin lamented, to the idea of a normal parliamentary path without any collisions. Yet he was ready to act more forcefully with Moscow's support. Gottwald wanted Soviet troop maneuvers on the country's borders to pressure Benesch. Stalin, however, still acting in accordance with Kennan's script, refused to provide such overt cover. As Washington had neither the will nor the means to resist, there was no need to show his hand. He would rely on the Soviet police he had sent into Prague a few days earlier. Communist Minister of Information Václav Kopetsky, however, declared that the Red Army was massed on the frontiers, ready to intervene against the reaction. The Soviet embassy remained silent. On February 20th, with no sign that the communists would abandon their takeover of the police, the 12 non-communist ministers submitted their resignations. Gottwald rejoiced at the naivete of their tactic. "I could not believe it would be so easy. I prayed that this stupidity over the resignations would go on and they would not change their minds." He denounced them publicly as lackeys of domestic and foreign reaction, traitors to the nation, who could never be part of a new government. "They want," he said, "to make the country a paradise for all the spies and saboteurs sent among us from abroad, against our republic and our allies, particularly against the Soviet Union." Benesch tried to reassure the Democrats. "Naturally, I shall not accept your resignations," he told the anxious ministers. "The communists must give in," he insisted. "I will not compromise." But the president had also been speaking to Gottwald, and his public comments were less clear-cut. He told the press he would accept neither a cabinet of technicians, which Gottwald falsely claimed his opponents wanted to impose, nor one without communists. There was no defense of the Democrats, nor any demand that the entire cabinet resign. Meanwhile, the communists were organizing Bolshevik-style committees of action around the country and ordering police officials to pledge their loyalty to the government of Clement Gottwald and to obey all the orders of the Minister of the Interior. Workers were instructed to attend communist rallies around the country. Those who refused were locked out or beaten. Ripka found the rhythmic ovations at the events terrifyingly similar to those delivered at demonstrations staged by the Nazi occupiers just a few years earlier. On February 21st, Gottwald told Benesch that if he refused to accept the resignations and allow the formation of a communist government, there would be a general strike and workers' militias in the streets. "Then there is also the Soviet Union," he added pointedly. The next day, Zorin and the entire Soviet embassy staff attended a communist-organized congress of the Union of Soviet Czechoslovak Friendship, timed to commemorate the 30th anniversary of the Red Army. Gottwald used the occasion to blast the Western imperialists who were trying to revive capitalism and fuel German irredentism. It was, he said, necessary to stand with the country's Soviet ally. "The law," he closed, "should strike all those who undermine the basis of our foreign policy." Pravda and Radio Moscow backed the Czech communists unreservedly, which was duly reported in the Czech communist press. Still, Benesch insisted to the National Socialist ministers that he would not give way to a coup d'état or second Munich. But Benesch was ill and infirm, and the pressure around him was growing by the hour. On February 23rd, Minister of Defense General Ludwig Svoboda declared that the army stands today and will stand tomorrow beside the USSR and its other allies to guarantee the security of our dear Czechoslovak Republic. The communist-controlled Interior Ministry occupied the offices of the non-communist press, instituting measures to prevent them from disturbing public opinion by lies and provocations. By the 25th, they were taking the same editorial line as Moscow and the communists. Gottwald secured the cooperation of rebel members of the non-communist parties, effectively making them part of his own party, and submitted a new cabinet list to the president. A communique declared the commitment of the new renovated National Front to the purging of the political parties whose responsible leaders have abandoned the principles of the National Front, and to tightening the alliance with the Soviet Union and the other Slav states. Steinhardt cabled Washington, comparing Gottwald's political tactics to those of Hitler. Bohlen had years earlier opined that a non-communist premier with communist ministers would be like a woman trying to stay half-pregnant. But Gottwald's action suggested that a communist premier with non-communist ministers was also implausible. At noon on February 25th, to the shock of the now former National Socialist ministers, the country learned from the radio that Benesch had accepted their resignations. Telephoning his office, Ripka would be told only that the president had approved Gottwald's cabinet list. Swearing in the new ministers on the 27th, Benesch would explain that he was trying to prevent the crisis escalating. The people were so divided that everything might end in confusion. The chief of his chancellery, Jaromir Smutny, later told foreign journalists that the president had wanted to avoid the danger of a civil war. Benesch would resign a few months later, on June 7th. Gottwald would be elected president the following week. 10 years ago, Czechoslovakia fell under the sword of the hereditary enemy who had threatened her throughout the centuries, Ripka wrote. In 1948, she was subjected by Soviet Russia, her ally, from whom she had expected aid and protection against the German danger. The Czech Democrats had made a grievous miscalculation, both that a post-war Germany would threaten her security and that the Soviet Union would guarantee it. In the weeks following the coup, there would be mass purges and arrests. These were followed by a rewriting of the Constitution and rigged parliamentary elections. Although non-communists had garnered 62% of the vote in the last free elections, in May 1946, Gottwald's power grab took place in a general atmosphere of resigned calm. A pre-war Czechoslovak population, with 357,000 Jews and 2.5 million Sudeten Germans, the cosmopolitan commercial and industrial backbone of the country, might have offered more spirited resistance. But the post-war population, now dominated by small farmers and artisans, was more inclined, as they had been during the war, to adapt than to fight. Masaryk accepted reappointment as foreign minister, explaining to Steinhardt tearfully that he wanted to soften the impact of communist ruthlessness and perhaps aid others in leaving the country. But his tenure was brief. In the early morning of March 10th, his body was found on the ground below his third-story office in the foreign ministry. Steinhardt and Ripka thought it was suicide. Dertina had tried to kill himself in a similar fashion only 2 weeks prior. A forensic investigation by the Prague police over half a century later, however, concluded what many had believed at the time, that Masaryk had been pushed. An earlier journalist's investigation also concluded that the Soviets and the Czech communists knew that Masaryk had been planning to flee the country, which threatened to turn him into an embarrassing cause célèbre. They therefore took preventive action. Ripka himself only escaped to France by dint of some remarkable good timing and fortune. Kennan later wrote that Masaryk's death dramatized, as few other things could have, the significance of what had just occurred in Prague. The communist Clementis took over as foreign minister. In short order, Washington's carefully assembled intelligence network in the country was dismantled, its leaders executed. The coup raised the uncomfortable question, who lost Czechoslovakia? As Office of European Affairs Director John Hickerson put it to Marshall, the absence of any sign of friendly external force was undoubtedly a major factor in the limp Czech collapse. Unlike in Poland, it had not been preordained that the country would be swallowed by the Russian bear. Czechoslovakia had emerged from the war unaligned. Hitler and Stalin had not allocated it in their pact. Stalin and Churchill had not included it in their percentages deal. The Allies had not discussed its orientation at Yalta or Potsdam. Both the Soviets and the Americans had liberated it. Kennan had thought it inevitable that Moscow, which saw only vassals and enemies near its borders, would do whatever was required to make it one of the former. But others disagreed. Hawkish scholar and State Department official Eugene Rostow later reflected that failure to deter the communist takeover of Czechoslovakia in 1948 was one of the most serious mistakes of our foreign policy since the war. Alan Dulles, who would become director of the CIA 5 years later, blamed the calamity on incompetent American diplomacy and intelligence operations. Whatever cards Washington had to play, diplomatically and militarily, it gave up most of them in 1945. I believe that Russia wants to and will cooperate in Czechoslovakia, Roosevelt told Masaryk. Red Army officials, however, made clear to their Czech counterparts that the country would be brought within the Soviet sphere. Beneš was ordered, under the threat of losing Czech territory, to cut ties with the Polish government in exile in London, with whom he had braved the war years, and to recognize the Soviet-controlled Lublin Poles. What capacity the U.S. Army had to countervail was circumscribed by the decision of Generals Marshall and Eisenhower to stop its advance 50 miles west of Prague. The Red Army, which had been 150 miles further from the Czech capital than Patton, marched into Prague on May 9th. It was one of its easier victories, but also one of great subsequent historical significance. "We could have liberated Prague," lamented one bitter U.S. embassy official. "After the war, we spent a lot of time trying to convince the Czechs that they weren't part of the Eastern Bloc. But no matter what we said, the Soviets came to Prague first." The Czech communists used this to great advantage, proclaiming it as evidence that only the Russians cared about Prague's citizens being brutalized by the Nazis. In the months that followed, the War Department agitated for a complete withdrawal of U.S. troops from Czechoslovakia. There was, Murphy said from Germany on August 31st, no overriding political necessity for their presence. Steinhardt was appalled, arguing that it would make the Czechs feel that they had been morally as well as physically abandoned by the Americans at the very time they were just beginning to show signs of courage in standing up to the Russians. No one knew for sure how many Soviet troops were in the country at the time, but estimates ran from 165,000 to more than twice that. Truman decided to write to Stalin on November 2nd, proposing a simultaneous American and Soviet withdrawal by December 1st. Given that such a deal would tip the military balance of power in the country overwhelmingly to the Soviets, who would have hundreds of thousands of soldiers available near its borders to smother the country as necessary, Stalin agreed. Beneš was thrilled to see the foreign forces leave his country, assuming naively that it signaled Stalin's commitment to its independence. He, as well as Steinhardt, also thought, wrongly, that Gottwald and his fellow communists were Czech patriots. Patriots who would be content to take a back seat in government rather than appeal to Stalin to put them in the front and kick the Democrats out. By the summer of 1946, however, it had become clear to Beneš and Masaryk that the communists were taking orders from Moscow, and that keeping the Red Army out was worth more than bringing U.S. aid in. They had seen the fate of the non-communist London-based Polish government in exile at Moscow's hands. When at a Paris gathering of foreign ministers in August 1946, Masaryk applauded Wyszynski's condemnation of American loan officers as economic enslavement, Burns and the State Department turned against them. Beneš begged Steinhardt to understand that such regrettable public gestures were the price his country paid for being permitted a measure of domestic democracy. But with Masaryk's behavior being called out in the New York Times, and the communists who railed against dollar imperialism blocking any progress on compensating Americans for nationalized property, there was no way diplomatically to repair the breach. When the following summer the Czechs, under orders from Stalin, rejected the Marshall Plan, the State Department wrote them off as a natural part of the communist East. It did so despite important voices arguing otherwise. The U.S. chargé in Prague, John Bruins, said that 80% of Czech people favor Western-style democracy over communism, and pleaded for the United States to help consolidate this pro-Western sentiment. Steinhardt pointed out that nearly 80% of the country's total foreign trade is still with the West. Masaryk begged Washington to understand the difficult situation caused by Czechoslovakia's contiguity to the Soviet sphere. His pleas fell on deaf ears. Division of Central European Affairs Chief James Jimmy Riedelberger dismissed him as weak or blind. His thinking was both self-justifying and self-fulfilling. The State Department relied on it to make the case, to themselves and the rest of the world, that they could not help those who would not help themselves. After all, Kennan, Clayton, and Marshall had attached this fundamental principle to the Marshall Plan. The initiative had to come from Europeans themselves. America could not save nations that had lost the will to fight. This was a convenient rationalization, as it meant that the State Department had not lost Czechoslovakia. The country, rather, never had what it took to be a Marshall Plan state. As for the Czechs, abandoned as they were by the West in 1938, they saw the State Department's froid dur as confirmation that America was still uninterested in them. Many saw its growing support for rapid German recovery as outright hostility toward their interests. Masaryk and his fellow Democrats believed they had no alternative but to reach an accommodation with Moscow. That they could not, in the end, do so, showed starkly how seriously Stalin took the threat to his eastern security buffer represented by the Marshall Plan. He could not ultimately abide non-communists having any real power in the country. "Those goddamn Americans," Ripka said after agreeing to a grain deal with Moscow in December 1947. "It's because of them that I've had to come here to sign on the dotted line. We told the Americans and asked for 200,000 or 300,000 tons of wheat. And these idiots started the usual blackmail." At this point, Gottwald got in touch with Stalin, who immediately promised us the required wheat. "These idiots in Washington have driven us straight into the Stalinist camp. The fact that not America, but Russia has saved us from starvation will have a tremendous effect inside Czechoslovakia, even among the people whose sympathies are with the West rather than with Moscow." It is, of course, far from clear that Washington could have prevented the collapse of democracy in Czechoslovakia. Stalin may well have used force to ensure it, and the United States would have had few attractive options to counter it. But the converse is clear, that democracy could not have survived without diplomatic and economic assistance from Washington. When the communist putsch came in February 1948, Marshall was unmoved. A seizure of power by the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia would not materially alter the situation which has existed in the last 3 years, he wrote to Caffery in Paris on the 24th, the day before Beneš gave Gottwald the green light to form a new government. "Czechoslovakia has faithfully followed the Soviet line in the United Nations and elsewhere, and the establishment of a communist regime would merely crystallize and confirm for the future previous Czech policy." Marshall was only concerned about the probable repercussions in Western European countries. In acknowledgement of the role the Marshall Plan had played in Moscow's toppling of the Czechoslovak government, Washington became more cautious with aid to avoid giving it a pretext for interference in border states. Stalin told the Finnish delegation in 1945, the Soviet policy toward their country was one of generosity by calculation. But such forbearance, Washington knew, would cease once it failed a cost-benefit test. After receiving $35 million in U.S. export-import bank credits in 1945 and 46, $452 million in today's money, Finland would thenceforth receive only warm indications of American regard and respect for its special position. Further large loans, the State Department reasoned, risked provoking Soviet countermeasures that would reduce Finland's freedom of action and access to the West. Even after the Marshall Plan had been wound down in 1952, the National Security Council would warn of the need to steer clear of any action that could give rise to drastic Soviet measures inimical to Finnish independence. In the case of Tito's communist Yugoslavia, however, which shared no border with the Soviet Union, Washington ramped up economic and military assistance In line with Kennan's urging to help deepen the rupture with Moscow, the aid at times included a humanitarian component, such as $38 million, $381 million in today's money, for famine relief in 1950, which was gratefully welcomed by the populace, but was manifestly geostrategic in nature. It would pay off with Tito's abandonment of the Greek communist insurgents in 1949 and condemnation of North Korean aggression in 1950. And with regard to Germany, Washington would move with renewed urgency to claim the zones under Western occupation as a permanent part of the democratic capitalist sphere. 10. Passage. March 1, 1948. The packed Senate gallery was silent. It was nearly a year since Truman had delivered the speech that became his namesake doctrine, 9 months since Marshall gave voice to a plan to define and to dignify it. Kennan cloaked the plan in a diplomatic strategy. Clayton gave it economic principles and resonance. Many others, Acheson, Clay, Bolin, Lovett, Caffery, Douglas, Harriman in particular, lent it practical and political substance. But the snow-haired, bow-tied, bespectacled 64-year-old Republican senator who took the lectern that day, white handkerchief poking from the pocket of his somber suit, was as essential as any of them in forging the bill necessary to give the plan effect. Former isolationist and steadfast opponent of spendthrift government, Arthur Vandenberg, had credibility with the Republican Congress that even the storied General Marshall could not match. He had drafted and typed his 9,000-word speech himself, reworking it 7 times. "Mr. President," Vandenberg intoned with the presence of a studied speechmaker, a man the New York Times called unquestionably one of the best orators in the land, "with the unanimous approval of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, I report the Economic Cooperation Act of 1948, that is the Marshall Plan, in its perfected text. This legislation, Mr. President, seeks peace and stability for free men in a free world. It seeks them by economic rather than by military means. It proposes to help our friends to help themselves in the pursuit of sound and successful liberty in the democratic pattern. The quest can mean as much to us as it does to them. It aims to preserve the victory against aggression and dictatorship which we thought we won in World War II. It strives to help stop World War III before it starts. It fights the economic chaos which would precipitate far-flung disintegration. It sustains Western civilization. It means to take Western Europe completely off the American dole at the end of the adventure. It recognizes the grim truth, whether we like it or not, that American self-interest, national economy, and national security are inseparably linked with these objectives. The Iron Curtain must not come to the rims of the Atlantic, either by aggression or by default. There is only one voice left in the world, Mr. President, which is competent to hearten the determination of the other nations and other peoples in Western Europe to survive in their own choice of their own way of life. It is our voice. This bill is the final product of 8 months of more intensive study by more devoted minds than I have ever known to concentrate upon any one objective in all my 20 years in Congress. It has its foes, some of whom complimented by their transparent hatreds, but it has its friends, countless prayerful friends, not only at the hearthstones of America, but under many other flags. It is a plan for peace, stability, and freedom. As such, it involves the clear self-interest of the United States. It can be the turning point in history for 100 years to come. If it fails, we will have done our final best. If it succeeds, our children and our children's children will call us blessed. May God grant his benediction upon the ultimate event." Senators and guests rose in applause. Polls found that nearly 80% of the American public had now heard of the Marshall Plan, up from under 50% in November 1947. Of those who had heard of it, favorable opinions outnumbered unfavorable ones by over 3-1, 57% versus 18%. These numbers were both a reflection of Vandenberg's assiduous shepherding of the legislation through the political process and a vindication of the personal risks he, as a presumed presidential candidate, took in adopting Truman's policy as his own. But for Vandenberg's leadership and coordination in the Senate, Marshall reflected several years later, the plan would not have succeeded. I feel that he has never received full credit for his monumental efforts on behalf of the European Recovery Program, and that his name should have been associated with it. Meanwhile, over in Europe, officials from the United States, Britain, France, and the Benelux nations gathered in London for the most consequential conference on the future of Germany since the war's end. Douglas cajoled the French tactfully, behind the scenes, using hints that their share of Marshall aid might depend on their cooperation in merging Germany's western zones. But events on the ground also helped his case. The French greatly fear the Russian advance in Central Europe, noted a memo to Washington. Little was heard any longer concerning reparations or hymns of hate for the Germans. There was talk of a Franco-German, perhaps even pan-European, collaboration for reconstruction of the post-war world. On March 5, 1948, the three allies issued a historic communique announcing a plan to coordinate economic policies between the Anglo-American buy zone and the French zone to incorporate Western Germany into the Marshall Plan and to create a West German federal government. The launch of what came to be known as the London Program set off alarms in the Kremlin. On the basis of restored industry in Western Germany and its massive Ruhr military-industrial system, Foreign Ministry official Vladimir Treskov concluded, the Marshall Plan aimed to create an arsenal and bridgehead for future aggression. Khrushchev would later reflect that the initiatives represented a direct threat to Soviet national security, a challenge to the impregnability of our borders. Within the last few weeks, Clay cabled the Army General Staff's Director of Intelligence, I have felt a subtle change in Soviet attitude which I cannot define. War might now come with dramatic suddenness. In Berlin, Murphy reported to Marshall, the Soviet delegation now seizes upon every question and every statement to launch violent propaganda attacks. Shown Clay's bombshell on March 15th, a distressed Kennan was sure the general had overreacted. Events in Prague and tensions in Berlin were, he wrote, predictable, defensive reactions on the Soviet side to the initial success of the Marshall Plan. But the consequence was that a real war scare ensued. The Air Force and Army leadership began planning contingencies for nuclear weapons deployment in Europe and the Mediterranean. For its part, the CIA could only reassure the president that war was not probable within the next 15 to 60 days. The seizure of power in Czechoslovakia and the incorporation of Finland within the Soviet military sphere, Lippmann wrote on March 15th, must be regarded as strategic actions planned by military men in anticipation of war. Stalin was pressuring Finland to sign a defense pact, the trigger being his realization that the Marshall Plan was an imminent reality that would consolidate a large part of Europe against Russia. Reston noted that the United States was committing itself and half of Europe to the Marshall Plan, which has roused the objections of the Soviet Union, but we have not yet organized a security system that will defend our friends on the continent or restrain the Russians. It made no sense, he said, to ship a lot of Marshall Plan goods to Europe to be taken over by the Red Army. Bevin urged Marshall to recognize the strategic threat involved in the extension of the Russian sphere of influence to the Atlantic. Marshall, who had for months resisted his entreaties to begin creating a Western military pact, now told his British counterpart that the United States was prepared to proceed at once in the joint discussions on the establishment of an Atlantic security system. Though the two kept Paris in the dark over the talks for fear of leaks to Moscow, their worries were misplaced. The latter was already being kept informed by British double agents Donald MacLean and Guy Burgess. Congress, too, was on edge. The coup d'etat in Czechoslovakia, observed World War II OSS official Edward Meade Earle, changed the whole climate of opinion on the